From NPR News, this is News and Notes. I'm Farai Chidea. Last week, the U.S. House of Representatives passed an unusual bill. It sounds a little bit like science fiction. The bill basically tells insurance companies they can't deny you coverage if you have genetic markers for a debilitating disease. This legislation is a sign of how far DNA and genetic testing have come. The government's bill is called the Genetic Information Non-Discrimination Act. It passed by a vote of 414-1. And for a closer look at the issue, we've got Neil Troutwine, a health lobbyist and the vice president of the National Retail Federation, plus Jamie Brooks. She's a senior analyst on bioethics, law, and society at the Center for Genetics and Society. Welcome to you both.
Thank you.
Thank you.
It's
a pleasure to be here.
So let me start out with one scenario. In the 1970s, the African-American community faced a crisis of genetics. Insurance companies denied coverage to people who had the gene for sickle cell anemia. Some were even tested without their knowledge. So, Jamie, will this act prevent scenarios like this from happening again?
It's certainly a step in the right direction. In addition to the incident that you just mentioned in the 1970s, it's continued to happen. And I think that the genetic non-discrimination legislation will provide litigators and advocates with tools to prevent that from happening in the future.
Neil, do you think this act is the best way to keep doctors and scientists from crossing boundaries that include privacy and ethics?
It never hurts to have clear signposts that essentially set a do not tread position. Certainly the incident in the 70s that Jamie cited is unconscionable. And I think as you look at the breadth of the employer community, we don't want to discriminate on this basis because, you know, which direction is the microscope going to point in? So, you know, I think the question all along while we were working on this legislation was how precisely it was drafted and what are the consequences that can flow from it that are beyond the scope of what we're trying to protect.
Is there anything in the bill as written right now that you don't think should be there or something that's not there that you do think should be there?
We would have preferred there be one clear national standard. Instead, you've got 50 different state standards plus the national standard. So that's going to be a little bit confusing to work with. We worry a little bit about the potential for litigation. If I'm an aggrieved employee, I may want to throw the kitchen sink against my present or former employer. We worry about as well about what we call business necessity inquiries, where we're manufacturing a particular product, and we may want to make sure that our workers are safe in those environments. In fact, we may be under stricture from OSHA.
Well, let me get Jamie in here. When it comes to this bill, I mean, you can certainly respond to Neil directly, but also in general, I would ask the same question of you. What do you think, if anything, belongs in the bill that's not there or should be taken out that is there?
Well, I have 2 points. In response to Neil's point on litigation and this the genetic non-discrimination legislation opening up businesses to unnecessary litigation, it's a legitimate concern to some extent, but multiple states have already enacted legislation that's very similar to the genetic non-discrimination legislation, and they have not experienced a flood of lawsuits that some of the opponents of GINA are anticipating. I would also say that while the bill is a step in the right direction in terms of protecting one's genetic information and protecting individuals from genetic discrimination, we would like to see life insurance companies included. Right now, they're not included in this bill and have the ability, theoretically, to use the data to discriminate against individuals. Furthermore, the consumer genetic industry, or direct-to-consumer testing, as it's called, is widely unregulated. And in part, the individuals may feel now that if this legislation is to pass, that they have their genetic information protected and partake more frequently or with less concern in direct-to-consumer testing in the retail consumer genetic industry, where it's still widely unregulated.
All right. Let me give you another scenario. Suppose that your family has a history of obesity and type 2 diabetes, which can sometimes accompany obesity. That may or may not be genetic. So would that be covered, do you think, Jamie, if, for example, you didn't know if it was genetically linked or it was just behavior?
Well, I think you hit on something really important there, and it's something that we're seeing in the media. There's a lot of attention and a lot of coverage on genetic information and genetic predispositions to disease, such as obesity and type 2 diabetes. And we do know there are several instances where a single gene or a single gene variant directly corresponds with a medical condition, like sickle cell anemia, Tay-Sachs, for example. But mostly what we know at this point is that there may be a correlation between a gene and a medical condition or disease. And it's far too early for us to discern with any specificity that, you know, a gene or a gene combination is the direct result of a health condition. And so I think, again, you tap into something really important, that our health is a combination of our genes and the environments we live in and how we take care of our health, the neighborhoods we live in. You know, it's wide. There are many non-medical determinants that impact a person's health.
Neil, you mentioned the possibility of lawsuits being one that you're concerned about representing, you know, as you do retailers. But what about specifically insurance companies and life insurance companies seem to be the ones that would bear the brunt of the new legislation, not necessarily other employers? Or if you don't feel that's the case, why specifically do you think everyday employers would really face a lot of burden and scrutiny because of this?
There are actually two titles to the legislation that President Bush is expected to sign. One affects insurers, and I concur with Jamie that perhaps the life industry should be in the scope as well. The second title deals with employment issues. So by statute, it will affect us. What's going to be particularly interesting is kind of the interplay between the new act and employer and insurer efforts on wellness and prevention. We don't want we want to help people get healthier, stay healthier, and in turn they are more productive and help lower healthcare costs. We don't want to be screening people at the employment door or getting into employment decisions based on health status. But generally, we know 3/4 of every healthcare dollar come from chronic healthcare conditions. And one of the things that we're all going to have to look for as this new law goes into practice is that it does not constrain what should be a national effort to get us all to address the environmental side and help make healthier workers.
Jamie, when it comes to law, there's also, with a new president coming in, Republican or Democrat, the possibility that there will be a change in the healthcare system. If that change goes as far as universal health care or something similar to it, how would that shift the debate over these genetic issues?
Sure. It should be no secret that I operate from the framework that health is a human right and a strong advocate for universal health care coverage. That being said, I think if we were to see some form of universal health care implemented, that also is a step in the right direction. I don't think that would negate the need for legislation specifically directed at protecting individuals from genetic discrimination. But it also plays into the United States is one of the few developed countries or with a developed economy that does not provide some type of universal health care coverage, which is in part some of the reason we have concern about genetic information being used against individuals adversely. And having universal health care coverage would indeed continue to provide ways to protect individuals in that way.
Neil, do you have any plans to for your association to lobby or to otherwise try to affect the debate over this bill as it proceeds quite likely into law to get some of the changes you're talking about?
Well, we certainly will be in consultation within the administrative process with the agencies who will write the regulations, principally the Department of Health and Human Services, the Department of Labor, as we always do in the process. I don't think you will see the hallmark issues. I don't think those can be shifted in the legislative process, but we will continue to work to try to make sure that it addresses the particular effort of deterring the misuse of genetic information, providing protections and confidence for individuals that their genetic information will not be misused, but are also not overly burdensome to businesses.
Well, Neil and Jamie, thanks so much.
Thank you.
Neil Troutwine is a health lobbyist and vice president of the National Retail Federation, and Jamie Brooks is the senior analyst on bioethics, law, and society at the Center for Genetics and Society. She joined us from UC Berkeley's Graduate School of Journalism. And just ahead, how the tragedy in Myanmar will affect which countries get aid around the world, plus Emmanuel Jal, a former child soldier who's using song to tell stories about violence, responsibility, and redemption. This is News and Notes. I'm Farai Chidea. It's time now for our Africa update. News reports say 12 people were killed and another 30 wounded on Sunday in North Darfur when the Sudanese government bombed a school and a marketplace. The UN says it can't get humanitarian workers to the victims. Today we're going to talk about some other big stories from Africa, including the ongoing issues with the presidential election in Zimbabwe and how the natural disaster in Myanmar, which has left at least 20,000 people dead, will affect aid to other nations. For more, we've got Imani Countess. She's Senior Director of Public Affairs for Trans Africa Forum. Imani, welcome.
Thank you, Farai.
So let's talk Zimbabwe first. It took 5 weeks, but the results for the presidential race were finally released. Opposition leader Morgan Tsvangirai won, but he didn't get more than 50% of the vote, according to the released results. And so, therefore, Zimbabwean law calls for a runoff election. Tsvangirai said he doesn't want a runoff. What will happen if he doesn't take part?
It's really unclear, Farai. What the government has said is that if he doesn't take part, then President Robert Mugabe will continue to run the country. But there are all kinds of discussions that are going on. And so at one level, the legal possibilities are only a part of the conversation, because there are a number of organizations, civil society groups throughout Zimbabwe, in South Africa, the African National Congress, and of course the government, and then multi-government formations like the Southern Africa Development Community, that are all engaged in informal conversations, kind of backroom conversations about which way forward for Zimbabwe. And there are a number of different scenarios that are on the table, depending on who you talk to.
One of those scenarios that's been mentioned is power sharing. But given the bad blood between these two competitors, is power sharing realistic?
I don't think that power sharing is realistic, and Trans Africa Forum doesn't believe that power sharing is realistic. In fact, what we're advocating for, Farai, is what's known as a transitional arrangement. And obviously the people of Southern Africa, and specifically the people of Zimbabwe, would need to determine what that type of transitional arrangement looks like. But essentially, what we would call for is a period of time where people in the country can engage in the immediate priorities. For example, developing a new constitution, democratizing the infrastructure in government, which has become so polarized and so identified with the ruling party, and creating basically an enabling environment so that a truly free and fair election could be held at some point in the future. Other groups are calling for power sharing. Over the weekend and last week, the U.S. government essentially called for Morgan Tsvangirai to take office because he had, from their position, won. And others are still calling for continued negotiations. And then, of course, the Zimbabwe government is calling for the runoff. So things remain very unclear at this point in time.
All right. Well, we'll keep an eye on that. And I want to move to another part of the world, to South Asia. Now, Myanmar, also known as Burma, was just devastated by a cyclone that killed more than 22,000 people. And that's just the most recent count. As many as 1 million people could be homeless. And with nations across the world, seeking food aid, something we discussed on Monday. How will this new tragedy affect which parts of the world get what aid and when?
The tragedy in Burma is just hard for us to comprehend. It is true that the current projections are that the numbers will rise significantly. I've heard numbers as high as 50,000 people being killed. So it's something that just automatically pulls at the heartstrings. And you know, Farai, scientists have discovered that human beings are actually wired to be altruistic. So it's a part of our DNA. It's natural for us to want to give. We see a crisis, we want to give. And so I think it's really important to acknowledge that and to really encourage people to give. It can. The giving, overwhelming giving for a major public emergency like this can have a negative impact on other parts of the world. We've seen it in the past. For example, when the tsunami hit Asia several years ago, where 250,000 people lost their lives, you saw relief and development organizations flooded with donations. Oxfam UK, at a certain point, actually had to refuse donations because they no longer had the capacity to actually program funds. So what I would actually advocate for those that are really interested in making a contribution is to give responsibly, to really look at those organizations that you are interested in making a contribution to, and making your donation in flexible kinds of ways.
For general support as opposed to necessarily for one thing.
Exactly, exactly. Because if you give for a tsunami or for the cyclone, or even quite frankly for Hurricane Katrina, those monies are earmarked. They're locked. And if the organization doesn't have a capacity to program those funds, your contribution could be sitting for years and years, and never really reach the intended beneficiary. Whereas if you give more generally to an emergency across the developing world, or another way to influence giving is to contact your member of Congress and direct them to send the message to USAID or to our representative at the United Nations to ensure that U.S. international giving is general so that it is able to reach those most in need around the globe.
Imani, the U.S. has pledged, just for starters, $250,000 to help Myanmar. But moving to another part of what you said, is it in a way, and I'll have to ask you to keep this brief, is it in a way a popularity contest, a horrible kind of popularity contest to see, you know, to judge what suffering is the worst and for people to send their money to that place?
Unfortunately, yes. Those emergencies that are in the news that, I hate to use the word, but that are sexy, do receive the most attention and therefore the most resources. And that's something that we have to combat. That's something that we have to recognize and deal with. And responsible giving, informed giving, is one way.
All right. Imani, thanks so much. Imani Countess is Senior Director of Public Affairs for TransAfrica Forum, and she joined us from our headquarters in Washington, D.C. At the tender age of 8, Emmanuel Jal was recruited to fight in a guerrilla war. He took up arms for the Sudan People's Liberation Army, a militia that was fighting the government of Sudan. As a child soldier, Jal went into battle carrying an AK-47 that was taller than he was. He later escaped to Kenya. Now Emmanuel Jal makes music that talks about his history as a child soldier and the need for peace. His new CD is War Child, and it mixes traditional African sounds with hip-hop vibes. Emmanuel recently shared some of his extraordinary life story.
I believe I've survived for a reason to tell my story, to touch life.
I was driven by my village when my village was burned down and we were running all over here and there, our cows, and my mom died in the time of the war, and then this my sister's displaced, and basically it's a kind of a revenge, a bit, you know, when you're bitter, you know. That's what driven me. So, but other people were freedom fighters like the adults. But as the young people, most of us were not forced to do it anything, to go to war. But the first battle wasn't easy. You know, you feel like you're scared, you know. But once you pull the trigger, you know, you just dance to the beat of the gun because it pulls you up and on until when you survive or when you're dead.
Your life took a lot of different turns where you trekked through the desert and not everyone who was with you survived. Later on, you met an aid worker, Emma McCune, who passed away later in a car accident, but she got you into Kenya. What was it like to decompress from being in a situation where every day you had to fight for survival to being in a situation where your life was more like the lives of people, for example, who might be listening to this radio show?
My escape, you know, and when the things were really horrible, you know, you kind of sometimes want to lose hope. Will this war ever end? What's going to happen? What's happened with my brothers and sisters? Because I lost contact with my family. So that was frustrating. And my trek in the desert wasn't easy, you know, seeing some of my friend die and watching somebody starving to death. It's not a good thing because someone becomes skinny. And also me getting tempted even to eat one of my best friend because there was no food and the cannibalism that broke out there. But when I arrived in Word, it wasn't easy because even though when I met Emma McCune and she had so much sympathy and wanting to take me and adopt me, in my mind I was still thinking I'm a soldier, but I had nightmares. She would wake up and try to talk to me. No, you're not in Sudan. You're in a safe place now. There's no war. Sometimes maybe if I'm in a place and bored, I may start playing like a soldier and naming stuff and fighting when there's no someone to fight. So it's crazy.
It's what people now call post-traumatic stress disorder. And do you ever deal with it now, just waking up in the middle of the night and thinking you might be back in a war zone?
would say, like, I would thank God most of my problems were in Kenya. Most of it, you know, because you see, when I came to Kenya, I got a lot of love and a lot of attention from different people, like Emma's friends and her, giving me good treat, taking me and appreciating me. And even when I'm wrong, they're not beating on me or jumping on me. So they were a bit soft to me and educating me. And also, because Kenya is amazing, I start going to churches, you know, and music. Where music, I listen to positive music that encourage, that is good for my soul. So, and listening to people's stories and getting to learn the world.
Bless you. For my size, just another little starving child running around in Africa, born to be wise.
Emma McKeon was a gift to our community. I only thought I was the only one rescued, but I realized she rescued over 157 child soldiers. And apart from that, wherever she goes, she touched people's hearts, mind, and leave a smile. And she was somebody who was dedicated, really, and loving the people. And wanting to do all her best to help them come out of the poverty, and also the heart she has for young people and demobilizing child soldiers. But apart from that, it's the love that she's given me, you know, staying with her. She took me to the best school in Kenya, and when she smuggled me, you know, I didn't have clothes to wear, so I was wearing her clothes, her shoes, and I was like a little brother because I'll sleep with her in the same bed. And also when I was in Kenya, people would tell her, why are you taking care of this kid? You're wasting your time. You should send him to a children's home or something, you know. And she didn't give up, and she gave me the best education. That's why I'm able to speak English. And there's nothing much, there's no way I can say thank you to her, but it's just to make her name known.
Let's talk about some of the other songs on War Child. There's one called Forced to Sin, where you talk about really what it's like to be a soldier. Tell me about that song.
Forced to sin to make a living. Forced to sin to make a living. Sometimes you gotta lose to win. Never give up, never give in.
When I was in a refugee camp, I did everything to survive, you know, and me and my friends, we used to go and steal chickens, and we used to go and pretend do other stuff, so just to make a living. And I've reached here because of the horrible things I've done, but I'm saying it's not great, but sometimes we are forced to sin to make a living.
We used to raid villages, stealing chickens, goats, and ships, anything we could eat. I knew it was rude, but we needed food. And therefore, I was forced to sin, forced to sin to make a living. Forced to sin.
You know, at this point in time, you've seen so many things that other people haven't, and you've written that into your music. Are you hopeful that your music can transform lives?
I'm hopeful because it's helped me as a person, and it's communicating for my country. And different places where I perform, I meet different people. They say, I'll listen to your music, and you're inspiring, and I thought I had so much problem, but just listening to what you're saying and looking at you just make me keep on moving. And it used to depress me talking about my story and doing all this, but it energized somebody and it makes somebody appreciate life. That's what also encouraged me to say, okay, nothing just happens, everything happened for a reason.
Emmanuel, thank you so much for sharing your story with us.
Sure, thank you.
Sudanese musician and former child soldier Emmanuel Jal, his new CD is called War Child.
I was born in Sudan in a place called Tony, in a village by the river where the people born strong. Respective of the fact that the place is war-torn, the people are still strong. Life is simple, people humble. They have been oppressed, but they overcame this kind of struggle. What I love about my people is that in the hard time they can still afford.
I'm Farai Chidea, and this is News and Notes. This month, News and Notes is focusing on issues surrounding criminal justice. On Thursday, we'll take a look at what it takes to get a fair trial, and today we'll look at this issue from the perspective of the judge's bench. African Americans are much more likely than whites to end up as defendants in the criminal justice system, but less likely to become judges. The most recent study showed that African Americans account for just 4% of judges nationwide. Today, Judge Lynn Toler gives us her take on how this affects the legal system. She's a former municipal court judge who now presides over TV's divorce court, and she's also a regular News and Notes contributor. Hi, Judge. How you doing?
I'm fine. How are you?
I'm doing great. So, you know, first off, at least in theory and in hope, judges are supposed to be unbiased. So why would race even be an issue?
Judges are supposed to be unbiased, and we all say that, and any judge worth their salt will say, I don't have any prejudices and biases. But in truth, we're all human, and there's nothing about donning that black robe that all of a sudden eliminates likes, dislikes, predilections, prejudices, and all those complex emotions that you have. So if you have a judiciary that is solely of one type, you're going to have a culture. Everything has a culture. Your community has a culture. Corporations have a culture. And if you are not exposed to, understanding of, and ingrained with other cultures, your culture is not going to understand that. So despite your best efforts to be non-biased, biases will creep in about which you are not aware.
Give us a sense of your path into the black robes, because 4%, considering that black folks are 13% of the U.S. population, 4% is a pretty sad showing.
Yes, it is. We have difficulty on a number of levels. First, we're always from a step behind, not as many people in the legal profession. Once we get into the legal profession, in states where there are elections, there are difficulty in one, it costs money depending on the size of the community that you're seeking a judgeship in. It costs a fair amount of money to get in there and to get elected. The way I got elected was I happened to be a rare commodity. There was a judgeship where 9 people were running in the race. I happened to be the only black person in the race, and my community was 40 to 45% black. I was told by the black leaders in the community that I would have no chance to vote, to be elected, because the black votership typically did not come out in numbers. We did a lot to change that in my race, and I only won by 6 votes. But so you're fighting several levels of difficulty, especially when you're elected. Now, there are other communities that have merit systems, and some of them, merit systems are good, but that merit system does have to be dedicated to the idea of diversity. Believe in it, understand it, and nominate people with that in mind.
There are the elected judgeships like you had, and then there's also appointed ones like the Supreme
Right.
Court.
Right.
It doesn't make a difference, really. Does either system tend to reflect diversity more, or?
I think it does make a difference. Different presidents, Lyndon Johnson and Carter, did a great deal in adding blacks to the at least district court bench, not as much on the appellate courts. So I think it is a little easier. You have one man, if he is dedicated to the idea of having a diverse judiciary in their lifetime appointments, your Article III judges. So you do have a better chance. On the state level, it tends to be so local with local prejudices and wants. In Ohio, we were talking about there's a name game going on, seats constantly being taken by guys with the same name. And a lot of people in elected places don't know who the judges are. When you have 40 judges on the Common Pleas Court bench, the odds you don't know who they are, what they represent, because they can't say anything really profound in their campaigning other than I will be fair and impartial. You don't know about their background. It's a difficult thing to do.
All of this said, given your experience, what do you think that some African American judges can bring, first of all, in the courtroom dealing with people who are accused of crimes, but secondly, among their colleagues?
I think they can bring a number of things. The one thing I think is most important is if they're just more black faces back there. I know everybody's going to think, well, that's just a dumb idea. But you have a section of society that feels totally alienated from the judicial system. We are overrepresented on the defendant side. If you run into a wall of white when you come to the justice system, you don't feel like you're involved in a place where maybe you did something wrong and you're involved in a community having to deal with you. It's us against them. Us as colleagues, I remember I spoke to a room of 100 judges. I was on a judicial committee for the education of judges. And my suggestion to them was that they did not understand. It was called the Many Faces of Justice. And there was one little table of black judges and everybody else was white. And I said, you can't think that this is okay. And you have to learn about the cultural realities of where you live, how differently they speak, how black people might have a different view of what's going in and how they might think, as many do, I'm dead on arrival and as such I should go down with a little bravado, and how you need to extend yourself further to those who may not believe that the system is fair, because belief in the fairness of the system is a necessary component to its performance.
Given that judges do have discretion in a lot of cases about, for example, whether or not someone can get a misdemeanor as opposed to a felony, do you think this really is affecting who's in prison right now?
Well, first you have to realize the first person who deals with whether there's a felony or a misdemeanor is the prosecutor, and it's prosecutorial discretion as to what they get charged with. A judge has no control over that. They can work out a deal or in a preliminary hearing reduce a charge, whatever. But the prosecutorial discretion is what most people don't see. That tends to be skewed a great deal. So by the time it gets to a judge's, a big chasm may have already arisen about the level of charge that's been leveled on a particular individual.
Judge Toler, who's going to fix this?
We all have to fix it. And we have to fix it by being conscious of what's going on before it goes on. When I went to classes after I was a judge, I was elected a judge, I said, if you remember nothing else I tell you today, when you're 18, you vote and you register to vote, because it does make a difference. 6 votes in my race. We have to be conscious of the judges, one. And number two, I think we have to change judicial education. When I took the bench, I was 34 years old. They put me on a robe, sat me in the chair and said, have at it. They did not ask me to think back about, you know, how do you judge credibility? How do you interpret different cultural realities? What do you do in circumstance when you're trying to split the baby? None of that occurred. And until judicial education catches up with the notion that, you know, putting on the robe does not presume an absence of humanity, then we're in the short run going to have continued difficulties just on that basis.
Judge Toler, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you so much.
That was Judge Lynn Toler. She's a former municipal court judge who now presides over TV's divorce court, and she's also a regular News and Notes contributor. She joined us from KJZZ in Tempe, Arizona. Mint Condition hit the music scene back in 1991 with a top 10 pop single, Breaking My Heart. Nearly 18 years later, the platinum-selling R&B group is still around. The 5 members work out of Minnesota and now have their own record label. Mint Condition's new album, their 9th, is called E-Life. I sat down with band members Stokely Williams, Jeffrey Allen, and Homer Odell to talk about getting their start with the iconic producers Jimmy Jam and Terry Lewis.
We actually had came out here in search of a record deal like earlier on, and it's just ironic that we ended up being on the same label that we came out here, and they were told us no and shut the door. No, get out of here, kid. And ended up, you know, through, you know, Perspective Records. But, yeah, we met these guys, you know, that were around town, just, you know, homeboys and everything, and we had our first or one of our showcases at First Avenue, and they came out to see us. They loved the show. You know, we invited, you know, the whole Prince family out, you know, at the time and everything. And next thing you know, he was up in flight time. You were having a meeting with him. And you're like, what do you all want to do? It's like, well,
we just want to make music and do our own thing, kind of, you know. So they were like, you guys can do the whole album if you want.
Staying in the past for a second, was the music industry as you got into it what you expected it to be? You know, I mean, obviously a lot of people dream about making a career. You made a career.
Right.
Was it what you thought it would be?
I don't even think I thought about it like that. I just wanted to do music. And that was one of the things that people who did music, they did. They just went and got a record. I thought you got a record deal and you went out and just played all. The business side of it, I didn't even think about. You know, I just wanted to make music. So at that point, when we got into it, it was probably learning that, you know, business is probably 90-95% of it, really, was probably my biggest shocker. And it was like, well, we can't play music today. We got to do, you know. So that was probably my biggest eye-opener getting into this game is like, wow, the business takes up so much time of it. And it takes away from just creating music that, you know, that was my downer for me. You know, the business being, this being more business than music. Always wondered why you ran that phone from the neighbor's house to our store.
You guys have been together for 18 years now. Did you think that you would ever reach a point where you had just stuck with each other so long? I mean, you've only had one person not be on this album out of the original six people. I mean, that's a huge accomplishment. What made you, you know, be willing to go the distance with each other?
It's something we always strive for. I mean, we always said that we never wanted like a big hit and want to retire from that. You know, it was the thing is, we always wanted a career, which is, you know, old school days, they had careers, and a lot of them are around still today, like the Temptations, and, you know, most people get in the music industry, they have, like, moments, you know. It's just like, and they're gone in 5 years. It's like the lifespan of an artist now is pretty rough. So, I mean, that's how we kind of measure our success. You know, like, in the old days, I mean, that's how they did it. You know, you stick together, you try to make it a career, a business, and figure out how you can parlay that into other things, and you try to enrich your life around it, you know, with family and other interests that you have. So we're blessed that we're still here and, you know, still relevant. People still digging what we do. Now we kind of talk, but just end up fighting. Try making up, but there's just no denying. Just ain't the same no more. What are we putting ourselves through all this for? You talk and hear me, but you can't communicate. Cause you're not listening. No, these are two different things. Now I see what it means to have been. What about this album? What was it like going back into the studio, having had, you know, time pass, and I'm sure all of you have had X, Y, and Z personal and professional developments. You've got lives that probably have other obligations. What was the process of recording this album? The process was what led us to the title, which is E-Life, you know, which has to do with the way the world is working now, electronically through email, downloading and file sharing, MPEGs and JPEGs, yada, yada, all that stuff. So so the title has more so to do with the approach than lyrically, which we do touch on some things lyrically as well, having deal with relationships in this in the texting age, you know, that we have now. This is a natural progression for us, I think. We've always been, like, interested in, like, technology, you know, being a live band and everything, you know, traditional in sense as far as instrumentation, drums, bass, guitar, horns. But we've always, you know, experimented with, for instance, on the Life's Aquarium CD that we did digital tracking then. You know, we kind of experimented, and the engineers were like, I don't know, is this good enough, the quality? And it turned out that it was. So everything turned out just right, you know. And experimenting with, for instance, they would file share with me, like, a track, and I'd sing on it, and then, you know, ship it off to Rick to do bass on it, you know. That was one way, and then we would set up, you know, too, like in a live kind of setting and do that as well. So
much of this was done in parallel or even, you know, at different times using technology.
Yeah, yeah.
Did you find that distancing or difficult?
Really, it wasn't as time consuming because everybody did it at their leisure kind of, you know, I'll get to this if I had certain time constraints or anybody else had certain time constraints. It worked out just by the end of this day, have it finished, you know, kind of thing. So, you know, the days we had to be there all together, we did that too. So it was like, this is real interesting. You know, I mean, like I said, this is the day I did a project. So last year with this guy I've never met, you know, from England. He emailed me a thing, emailed it back. It's on his record, you know. Mm-hmm. That's how people are doing music in business these days, you know. So there's all kinds of different ways. But, you know, we thought it was, it's still interesting music. And as long as we can always get our live element in there, you know, it's always good. But the thing is, to stay relevant, you always got to keep your ear to the street.
Give it up for my little baby girl. She come and comes me. Give it up for my little baby boy. Another one who brings me joy. And who ride like the best friends. Bring my little man to the end.
Would you or have you told your kids, yeah, music is a great thing to do, or stay away?
Oh, no.
What, Jeffrey?
I always tell him I'm doing this so you don't have to. This is why I'm doing it. You're gonna go on. You don't worry about it. You're going straight to college. There ain't gonna be no, I'm gonna take a year off. College will be here. No. You're going straight in. You're right. Finishing. Yeah. Then if you want to do something, that's yeah.
For me, well, I already have a daughter that plays. Actually, both of my daughters, one plays keyboards and the other one plays guitar. And the guitar player she's a true rocker. So you know. She's going to do something with it. Like I told him, whatever you want to do, as long as it's something positive, I'm behind you. Don't worry about it. I got you. Just, you know, keep it positive and we're cool. If it's music, then I'm cool. You know, it could be something worse. So.
Yeah, I know, absolutely.
Yeah, music game.
Yeah, that's right.
Well, gentlemen, it has been a lot of fun. Oh, thanks so much.
Thank you so much.
Thanks for having us.
That was Homer Odell, Stokely Williams, and Jeffrey Allen of Mint Condition. Their new album, E-Life, is out in stores today. They join me here in our NPR West studios.
To fix some breakfast, I make sure I check the lesson, 'cause one of these days.
That's our show for today, and thank you for sharing your time with us. To listen to the show or subscribe to our podcast, visit our website, nprnewsandnotes.org. To join the conversation or sign up for our newsletter, visit our blog at nprnewsandviews.org. News and Notes was created by NPR News and the African American Public Radio Consortium. Tomorrow, we'll round up the results of the presidential contest in North Carolina and Indiana with NPR senior Washington editor Ron Elving.